Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us. You're here listening to The Mark Steiner Show and to Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, and our environment. And you're listening to this program, of course, on WEAA-FM, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And to Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. And today we have a number of things in store for us on this program. On the way there, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. For more information, go to www.mecu.com. And WEAA, support for WEAA is provided by, in part, Bosch, offering Bosch dishwashers at Bray and Scarf. And we are going to launch our conversation today. Later on the program, we'll be talking to some young black farmers who had a conference in Baltimore, Maryland, and we'll be talking to folks from out in Washington State to talk about the Monsanto battle there over GMO labeling that actually their effort lost. Monsanto and those guys won. Right now we start a program with Michael Tabor, who's a farmer who supplies the Baltimore area universities with GMO-free, sustainably grown produce, and has run a farm stand at the Adams Morgan neighborhood for the last 40 years and been an activist for even longer than that. And Mike Tabor, welcome. Good to have you with us here on Soundbites in the Market.
Mark?
Good. And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888, as we talk with Mike Tabor in this first part of our Soundbites weekly feature. So, Mike, this is really interesting. I think this is what you sent us and what we talked about briefly when we saw each other in D.C. a few weeks back was something that I really wasn't aware of, and I think many people are not aware of, but it's the Food Safety Modernization Act. And it sounds like a fairly innocent act to protect our health. But talk a bit about what this is.
The act itself, you're right, is an act that's helpful. We have food outbreaks of toxins, poisons in the food. People get sick. And the act addresses that issue. The problem is that a lot of us feel the one part of the system that works is with local farmers, particularly farmers who grow things sustainably grown and organically grown. Our system, which is 50, 100 miles from our point of sale, is not broken. We have a very good system. The system of growing something in Mexico or California, shipping it, sealing it, and shipping it halfway across the country is what appears to be broken. And the onerous thing about this act is it places an incredible burden on family farmers. I think that's one. The second thing is when we think of food safety, when I think of food safety, and when you just mentioned food safety, we do think of GMO foods, which should be labeled, and we think of residues from pesticides and herbicides on the food. That's not food safety. The FDA defines food safety in a very different way, in a way that's, as I said, onerous to small and any size family farmer.
So let me ask this question, because I think that one of the things that I saw in the piece that you wrote with Nick and the pieces that I've seen in Mother Jones that were written by Tom Philpott,
right,
is that they are passing rules that affect the degree of dirt and bacteria on the food. So before we get into the deeper meaning of that, which we'll go to in a second, historically, I mean, wasn't the Food Safety Act written and created to protect our health because there were outbreaks, because there was dirt on the food, because people did get sick in the 20s and the 30s and 40s, and that's the reason that these acts came about in the first place?
Oh, that's right. Originally, and actually the act, as I remember, piggybacks on an earlier act, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And I think that a second act was passed in the late 30s. I think the process started in the early 30s, and the act was passed, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and it was meant to protect the public from all kinds of problems involved in food safety.
Because it began in 1906 with the Pure Food and Drug Act.
Right.
Right, and those were things, and part of it had to do with what Upton Sinclair and others pushed around safety of meat and
right.
safety of our food. So, I mean, so talk about what the contradiction is here, because when we think of that, we think of that as an act and an effort by the government to protect us from getting sick, and then the whole world of chemical additives came into being that heightened color, modified flavor, made textures different, and all the rest, and that was supposed to be a good thing, right?
You know, there's another part of this that you touch on that a lot of people don't talk about, with the exception of Michael Pollan. Michael Pollan wrote a piece in the New York Times magazine section at this point about 6 weeks ago on how our body actually needs more bacteria, how our lower guts, because of the industrial nature of our food system and the concept of sterilization of everything, you know, before you touch anything, we actually lack bacteria in our system. So we're talking about positive bacteria, not pathogenic bacteria. But in a lot of ways, the food system right now is too antiseptic and too industrialized. When the average person goes into, I don't know, a Whole Foods or any number of other place, they're getting virtually a sterile food, or they should be. That is a chlorinated apple, a food that goes through chlorinated baths. And that's an objection to a lot of us raising things from the earth that we clean, but we refuse to chlorinate.
So I do want to, in a moment here, get to the heart of what the real danger is for small farmers and our health when it comes to the new Food Safety Modernization Act and who's writing it and who has the power to do it and why they're doing it. I want to get to those points in just a few minutes. But what I'm trying to get to with you, Mike, first for our listeners, is the sense of the disconnect, to help bridge this disconnect between what has occurred in the last 40, 50, 60 years that has changed the nature of a food and safety acts, food and drug acts, that were there to protect us from diseases. People were dying. So they had to do something to protect people in America. People were getting sick. So what shifted? You understand what I'm saying? What is the change?
Yeah, there has been a direction in sustainability. When you had the introduction of toxic pesticides like DDT, for instance, there was the acknowledgement that eating food laden with pesticide residues was not good. And that's why the sustainable farm movement started, to grow food in a healthy way using composted manure, using natural ingredients to bring to the consumer healthy food. But in this case, defining healthy food as free from noxious chemicals on the food.
So tell me where this is going then. I mean, one of the things that we started talking about earlier was that, you know, when you buy strawberries or cucumbers or whatever you buy from farmers markets, and Mates has said we're seeing increasing numbers of people who are being able to use their independence card and food stamps to buy food at farmers markets, which is a very good sign because often it's out of reach for working people in America. But what you're seeing in farmers markets is that there are these kind of, as you wrote about, trace amounts of straw and soil on the vegetables you're buying. And so that is what the Food Safety Modernization Act authors are saying has to be curtailed.
Well, this is my personal objection, and I don't know how indicative it is of the rest of the movement, but I feel that the concept of strawberries, that is, strawberries grown on a fruit grown on straw, is the concept behind strawberries. There's not that.
Hence the name.
There's not that invisible blanket.
Right.
Food comes out of the soil. It comes out of the earth, as a lot of people would say, as we do also. And to separate and industrialize the food system that needs to be antiseptically pure, whatever that needs, which I think this act attempts to address, is addressing a system that's not broken. In terms of family farms bringing their food to the market, The difference is when you industrialize the method of growing growing food, ship it across the country, have it sealed, have it with PLU stickers on it. That's not food, as you and I basically understand. What people want when they come to our market is food with a morning dew still on it. And they don't mind. In fact, they like the fact that on the cucumber there's a little bit of soil residue. You know, sure, if they want to wash it, they could. But most consumers don't see that division and object to that division. Unfortunately, that's not the direction of food. The direction of food, if you go into, even when I went into my local co-op, which I delivered to in the Washington, D.C. area, you see everything sterile. PLU sticker, wrapped, sealed, coming from, as I say, either in the case of Taylor Farms, very popular type of salad mix, organically grown, it travels 3,000 miles. And there I could see there is a problem, but not when something is picked. I mean, look, I carry liability insurance. If anyone should get sick from anything I grow, I've got to be responsible. In fact, I have to make sure that food is safe or I'm out of business. And that's not what this act addresses. This act treats small-scale family farmers the same way it treats a large multinational industrial farm.
I mean, as in fact, what this new law does, it says that there's a $500,000 exemption that applies only to farms that sell more than half the produce to consumers. The problem is a lot of small farmers now are selling it to co-ops, food hubs. They're selling it to restaurants. So it could affect, and in fact, it could affect the majority of small farmers who sell directly to people like me and other people in this radio station and around this community.
You know, understand, there was that Tester-Hagen amendment that did exempt us. But the FDA and its regulations, and that regulation period ends this, the comment period ends this Friday, which is something I hope we could talk about.
But let's talk about it then.
That exemption fades very quickly. For instance, in a surprise and punitive visit to a neighbor's farm by the FDA, he happened to have, I think it was onions from another farmer that he was going to bring to market. That immediately took away his protection, his exemption, because he was now not a farmer but an aggregator. So even though he had a full-time food safety person, even though he was much better prepared than most farmers, that surprise visit in which he was unable to even get his food safety person there it took away his exemption. And this was not a definitive visit. This was probably a planning visit from an FDA official.
So talk about what you're talking about, this period we have now for public comment. You wanted to raise that. What is that?
Well, for the last several months, mandated. Understand, the act is passed. The act was passed in late 2010, early 2011. It's the regulations that are being written. So the regulation period ends this Friday. In terms of comments, there have been thousands of comments. This is an opportunity for the average person to make comments and express an interest in that. And there is an address.
Go ahead, please.
People could go to the NSAC, N-S-A-C, website and go to FDA and find out how to make comments about this. The unfortunate thing, and I'm just reading an industry publication which comes out each week called The Packer.
Mm-hmm.
So from 2 weeks ago, October 28th, there's a comment here from the Florida Agricultural Commissioner, Adam Putnam. And his point is it will make the rollout of Obamacare look like a well-oiled machine. And sure enough, beginning yesterday, the website was down. So that if you want to make a comment to FDA, as of the last couple of days, there's no way to do that.
Hmm.
And you could fax in a comment, you could mail in a comment, but once again, It makes you wonder about the capability of a federal agency to even allow the regulations, much less the administration of a program to happen.
Well, you raise in your article, as other people have raised in their articles I've been reading about this particular act, and I knew you were coming on, that the FDA's deputy commissioner, who is responsible for food safety, who has a hand in writing this act, is named by the name of Michael R. Taylor, who's a former Monsanto vice president.
Yeah, I mean, look, as you said earlier, the FDA started with good intentions. You know, it did start to eliminate nostrums, fake pharmaceuticals, fake chemicals, all in the interest of the consumer. But even when with one of the earlier jobs I had, which was with the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare in the late 60s, even then we knew that the FDA was a revolving door, in that case, with chemical and pharmaceutical companies. So it's not unusual that Michael Taylor, who has worked for FDA, I think twice before, and each time came back to Monsanto, and each time got promoted for his work to help Monsanto. And I guess I should be careful with saying that, because Monsanto is notorious for suing farmers.
Then talk to a host.
So, I should be a lot. I should be 500 farmers a year is what I read.
500 farmers a year.
Yeah.
Now, also, there's another article that I read that talked about who has also helped write this act, and this actually came from Tom Philpott's piece in Mother Jones, that it was the grocery association itself that actually helped put this act together and had a lot of lobbying. And, of course, they're the ones who sell the food you're talking about in grocery stores that are being hit in many ways by this growth of farmers' markets and people buying directly from farmers.
You know, if I believed in conspiracy theories, and I don't.
I'm not either, but.
But there are over 8,000 farmers' markets in the country. I forget what the exact figure. And in Baltimore, you've got several. You've got, I think you've got a number of farmers' markets.
Lots.
Scattered throughout Baltimore. I would say, if I was a conspiratorialist, and I'm not, that this act was designed to take out the one aspect of agriculture today that's a growth industry, small-scale family farms, that the intention of the act was to eliminate those farmers. And even before the regulations are written, a number of family farms have declared that it's not worth paperwork, it's not worth the cost, and they are getting into commodity farming and getting out of vegetable and fruit farming. I mentioned that in one of the pieces.
Commodity farming meaning what?
Raising of corn and soybeans, and unfortunately all the all the GMO crops. But a number of farmers just don't want the pain and don't want the added cost. I think the FDA, their quote about the average cost to farmers grossing over $25,000 a year, that is that number of farmers that take in under $500,000 a year, the average cost each year is in something like $25,000 a year. And to a lot of us, that eliminates our ability to make a profit. Now, as we speak, right now, in anticipation of some of that, we're putting a fence in around a several-acre field, which we're not required to do, but we know there's an issue with deer in our field. You know, that's one of those things we're doing in preparation for the implementation of FSMA. Another is building a better facility to process the food, understanding that when an inspector comes here, that those are positive things. But the cost is on us. If we have an inspector come here and he says, you've got to get this, and this corrected, that's going to cost us whatever it is per hour. I think the figure is $250 an hour to get reinspected. And there's little recourse for family farmers who object to anything that an inspector comes and sees on the farm that they don't think is up to par.
So we only have like 5 or 6 minutes left here, Mike. There's two things I want to make sure we get to. I mean, one, I want people to understand that these rules could change the entire nature of our ability to buy food from farmers at farmers' markets throughout the city, at co-ops, and directly from farms. It could really affect
a reasonable cost.
Right.
At a reasonable cost.
Right. So that's this is a very critical piece. And we're going to put on our website where you can go to if you go to sustainableagriculture.net, which will be on our website, they will tell you how to make a comment.
Yeah.
And so we will go there. That'll be on our website. But I want you, while we're here, is talk about the movement in Maryland to label GMO foods, which just failed in Washington State, which we're about to talk to in a few moments.
Could I just insert one quickie?
Sure.
And that is, we have two very, very powerful state senators, Senator Cardin and Mikulski. I'd suggest that individuals also send in comments to both of them, because this act requires the funding of 3,000 federal inspectors. And even if they get the regulations through, and even if they're, you know, the act is implemented, unless they can hire 3,000 inspectors, it's problematic for the FDA. And so sending comments to Barbara Mikulski and Ben Cardin are very important. So GMO foods, you know, it's sad. I mean, the industry, that the biotech industry, I think in Washington the figure was $22 million was spent to try and defeat, and successfully so, the legislation. I forget how much was spent in California, but I think it's actually more than that. So we're up against a huge system, and I'd love to be in contact with people in the Baltimore area who are interested in the GMO labeling bill in Maryland, which we actually have a planning meeting set up on how to work toward a GMO bill. And Baltimore is very important because the heads of the Environmental Matters Committees are both in Baltimore City.
Maggie McIntosh and who else? That's right. Don't mind. We'll figure it out.
But they're open to comments, and they're both in the same district. And
It's Senator Conway.
Joan Carter Conway
and Maggie McIntosh, yeah, right.
So it's very important if you live in their districts to let them know. And of course, you could be sure the related industries are going to be on top of this and are going to try and stop any bill from getting through. That means Chamber of Commerce, the Farm Bureau, any vested interest. They're going to pour, if necessary, millions of dollars to stop the consumer. Now, this is not a bill that says we're against GMOs. This is legislation that just says we'd like to know. We'd like to choose.
So how do people...
this infant formula has GMOs, I'd like to know that.
How do people get in touch with you and with this effort?
Well, my email is esiegel, E-S-I-E-G-E-L, 2, the number 2, at igc.org.
And we'll put that on our website as well.
And I just have to say, I really am a full-time farmer. I'm an activist, but as we speak, starting at 7 o'clock this morning, I was out in the field, and I'll be out in the field the rest of the day. And so this activism is just, you know, where I could spare time. that's not the case of an organization like the Farm Bureau that has, I think, two full-time workers in every county to fight legislation like this, as well as many thousands of members. And just like the NRA, they're the ones who are going to be vocal. Unfortunately, liberals and progressives are not as vocal when it comes to local issues.
Michael Tabor has been joining us this last half an hour. He is a farmer who runs a farm stand in Adams Morgan neighborhood for the last 40 years also supplies Baltimore area universities with GMO free sustainable grown produce. Mike Tabor, thanks so much for being with us. We'll have all the contact information on our website.
Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Yep.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking with Aaron Sagan about what happened from Yes Magazine, about what happened in the Washington State GMO vote, and we'll be meeting some young folks who went to a Black Farmers Convention here in Baltimore City where we are today. Stay with us. We'll be right back here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. Thank you. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA-FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM on the shore. And we are about to have a conversation about the GMO labeling campaigns that took place around the country. We're about to talk with Erin Sagan, who writes for Yes Magazine. The piece she wrote, Monsanto may have won the battle for I-522, but the future of food is not lost. And Erin, welcome. Good to have you on the show with us.
Thank you for having me, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. It's 7:30 over here on the West Coast.
Thank you so much for getting up early for us today. I appreciate that.
Oh, of course. No, I love talking about this.
So let's jump right into it. This is it was an interesting piece you wrote because the national press did – we covered it last week, and the national press did right the very next morning say that the GMO labeling bill lost in Washington State. That is to say that – the bill that would have said, the referendum would have said that GMOs have to label their foods. We have to label our foods knowing GMOs are in them. But so what is the real state of this? What's going on?
Well, you know, pretty much, yeah, most of the mainstream press was calling it, you know, not even 24 hours after, you know, ballots were in. And they've called it since, you know, they called it about, you know, yesterday or the 9th actually is when I saw final results posted on the Washington State site. No one, yes, on 522 lost. But once again, it was really interesting. It was so close. I mean, it was pretty much, I mean, very close to being the exact same numbers as California. It was yes gained 48% of the vote, no was 52. And the, you know, the spending on the no side was incredible. So this narrow of a margin, I do think is encouraging, you know, despite its defeat.
Now, well, one of the things that I want to explore with you here, let me just ask you this question first. So are you saying that all the votes are not in yet and you don't know who won or lost in this battle to label GMO, foods GMO or not GMO in Washington State?
At this point, we do know. You know, but I do want to say that it did take longer to see how narrow this margin got. I mean, we didn't see this, you know, immediately after, you know, polls closed, basically. So, no, I mean, it did lose, and, you know, pretty much all the votes are counted now.
So then the next question I have is, I was talking to my brother who lives in Seattle, and I asked him how he voted.
Yeah.
He said he voted for labeling, and he lives in the Seattle area. But I'm curious what you think both the politics and psychology are when a campaign like this starts in Washington State or in California, where they had the Proposition 37 that you mentioned in your article, that the huge numbers, vastly larger numbers of people, when they're initially asked the question, do you want your foods labeled to know whether or not they contain GMOs? So people can make a decision about what that means for them, whatever that is. But then by the time the campaign reaches the point of people voting on Election Day, that number has dwindled dramatically. What happens?
No, I know. Well, I kind of want to start out saying, like you're, you know, saying polls have been showing, and, you know, throughout the country, as well as Washington State, you know, and California, even immediately after the defeat of their labeling bill, you know, that people do want labeling. And so I think it says a lot about, you know, how powerful and how greatly, you know, effective money is in these campaigns, because, you know, the No on 522 campaign dumped like $22 million in. And from what I understand, you know, its most effective tactic was television marketing, you know, which is a very, you know, expensive platform. And the, you know, Yes Side just didn't. I mean, the No Side spent $22 million. The Yes Side spent about $7 million. And, you know, so I really think it can come down to marketing. And, you know, I think that people who are on the fence about this issue, with just so much money, you know, just affecting, you know, people's information, you know, I mean, I think that they were swayed to the no side. And, yeah, I mean, money was huge in this.
What is it, do you think, swayed people? What was it? What was the bottom line that swayed people, do you think, and sways people in states like California and Washington, which are more progressive than they are conservative and kind of people where there's a huge population of people who care about things like this? What do you think? What was the tipping point? I mean, we know that corporate money jumping into campaigns can change things because there's this massive advertising can kind of wrestle people's consciousness into submission when it comes to ideas. But what do you think it was? What was the issue that tipped people?
You know, I think that the really interesting thing is that the no campaign, you know, never really wanted to kind of tap into the right to know argument of the other side. They pretty much focused on the details of the initiative and, you know, and just, you know, basically kind of disparaging it, you know, saying it wasn't clear enough, kind of comparing it arbitrarily, you know, to other, other labeling, you know, mandates like nutrition and all these, you know, other things about how restaurants have to do it, but restaurants don't have to do it for other kind of labeling anyway. So, you know, it was kind of a moot point. It's people's right to know, but the no side really, you know, tried to argue that because that's a very popular notion among consumers and Americans. They were, you know, basically disparaging the initiative. And, of course, I think the biggest argument and most effective was that despite, you know, it being challenged time and time again, that it would raise grocery costs for families.
Right.
And their estimate was approximately $500 extra per year. And, you know, I mean,
it's a lot of money to a lot of people.
Yeah. It is. But, you know, that study was also contradicted by other people that what, you know, they were basically kind of, speculating that these food manufacturers would then replace their GMO ingredients with organic, you know, basically overhaul like their entire lines. And there just really isn't any evidence that is what would happen.
So, I mean, as in California and in other states, because of the issue of the cost to working and poor people that was raised, groups like the NAACP in California, not the national organization but the state organization, actually worked against Proposition 37. So, I mean, those kind of contradictions come to the fore in all these GMO battles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and also, I mean, similar that, you know, like often the no argument will say, you know, which is kind of ironic that those groups would sometimes join that side, is that, you know, well, labeling is kind of, you know, it's unnecessary because people can buy organic, but, you know, organic's really expensive and organic also isn't available, you know, in a lot of places, especially where like low income families live. And, it's sort of, you know, people shouldn't have to pay kind of like a luxury item in, you know, order to receive, you know, whole health and nutritious food. I mean, it's you know, we need labeling.
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Weigh in at steinershow@gmail.com about this particular issue. And because it is, I mean, this is, you know, when you see the kind of the power of money in politics, period. And that does have an effect on this. I mean, what were those numbers again you said earlier?
I'm sorry?
The numbers that you mentioned earlier in terms of what was spent on the no campaign as opposed to what was spent on the yes campaign and where that money came from?
Right, yeah. Well, so in you know, Washington, it was pretty much the same players, but the no side spent $22 million, and a lot of that was coming from the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which also gave, you know, huge amounts of money to the California No campaign. And so, yeah, compared to the no, the yes side, the pro-labeling side, it's still a significant sum, but compared to the opposing side, they only raised about $7 million. And so, they raised a good amount of money, but, I mean, they couldn't really compete, you know, with these huge corporate interests. And so Monsanto, though, you know, they directly donated a lot of money. They also donated money to the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which other food manufacturers are members of. It's a lobbying group. And they also dumped in the no side, rather, not necessarily GMA, $46 million to the California campaign, you know, which is a larger state, you know, to run an election campaign. So, 22 million. And it was just incredible how much, you know, you saw between like September and October. It was just, you know, more and more and more kept going into it.
So it's interesting. You also wrote that the Washington's Attorney General filed suit against the Grocery Manufacturers Association, who was a major donor to No on 522, saying that they violated state campaign laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so he filed suit, and then they ended up, they did disclose their donors. What was really kind of interesting about that, you know, aside from the usual suspects that you would see, was actually absence of some of the food corporations, you know, that, you know, did donate money to defeat the bill in California, kind of were staying out of it this time, because since the California campaign, you know, public opinion, you know, and really knowledge is shifting. Yeah, so it was corporations like Kraft, I believe it was Kraft, and, you know, Mars actually didn't donate to the Washington campaign because, you know, the certain does not look so good.
So what's next?
What is next? That is a very good question. when I spoke to exhausted, you know, campaigners and labeling, you know, advocates, the day after the polls closed, you know, they didn't really, you know, have any clear answers. I mean, you know, even before the election, nearly half of, you know, the states in our country have some kind of, you know, labeling legislation. You know, some of it isn't, you know, quite as, you know, as broad as it would have been, you know, like some of it kind of seems to stay more in the agricultural sector, you know, rather than with consumers. But from, you know, what I hear, and I don't really, you know, have enough information to be more detailed about this, but I understand that there's some petitioning going on in Oregon.
Right.
So basically the West Coast.
Now, and it's also happening here in Maryland, but we just had a segment on before that about efforts here to have that same thing happen in the state of Maryland.
Oh, excellent.
So
excellent.
It's happening across the country. And I do appreciate all the work you do and the writing you're doing, and look forward to having you back with us. Aaron Sagan is a member of the online editorial team for Yes Magazine, who wrote the piece that we'll be linking to. And, of course, we talk with Yes Magazine a lot on this program. And Aaron Sagan, thank you so much for being with us here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show this morning. Thanks for getting up early for us.
Oh, definitely. Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to some folks who went to the Black Farmers and Urban Gardeners Conference in New York City. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food farming and the environment here on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM out of Salisbury, Maryland. We are now about to talk with Alea Fraser, apprentice at Five Seeds Farm and Apiary, Imani Bryant, who is receiving her master's degree in public health from Morgan State University and works with issues of food justice, and Xavier Brown, who runs a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. called The Green Scheme. And welcome, Imani and Xavier. Good to have you on the program with us.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you all for joining us here. So I was really interested in this conference that took place. We did a number of shows about the what happened earlier in the week with decisions around Black farmers' compensation, these lawsuits that took place. But tell us about this conference and why you, as younger people here in our more urban areas, went to this conference. Imani, why don't you start off?
Well, my interest in urban farming was started when I was working at Baltimore City High School. Called Connection School for the Arts, and I started a urban garden with my students, who it was their idea. They said that their school lunches were horrible. and that there was no way that the city was going to make any changes to what they were providing the kids. So if they wanted to see changes in the lunch menu, that they would have to garden and produce their own food to be used in the cafeteria. So that's how I was originally got started in urban gardening. And then I met Aaliyah, a mutual friend of ours, and she brought me out to the farm where she apprentices at 5C's Farm.
Denzel Mitchell's farm.
Yes, and I went over there. I volunteered over there a couple of times throughout the summer, and that got me just to think even more so about urban gardening and just agency and cooperatives within the Black community. And I'm now currently working or interning over at the Men and Family Center at Charm City Clinic. And this is a free clinic in East Baltimore, and I'm looking at patient navigation and helping to coordinate patient care. And what I've noticed there is that the nutritional education is severely deficient, and having conversations around growing your own food as a preventative health measure. So I went to this conference with the intention of learning how to frame that rhetoric a little better and how to engage the community that I was working with in participatory, action-oriented research.
And Xavier, talk about your work in D.C. and why you ended up in New York. Then I have some very specific questions about what you all learned at this conference. Xavier?
Oh, okay. Yeah, cool. So my friends and I started a nonprofit called the Green Scheme in about 2010. It's an environmental nonprofit. Our main focus is on healthy food access and nutrition. And so we've started a food forest, a small food forest, in the second biggest public housing development in D.C. I really just wanted to go up to Brooklyn to connect with other Black people that are doing urban agriculture work and food justice work around the country to strengthen my network and hopefully strengthen their network and share ideas and the potential to grow and just learn more. So that's pretty much it.
So I'm curious what you learned, I mean, in this conference. One of the things we do know about that we've learned in past years recently that, you know, like the, back in 1920, 14% of all American farmers were African-American, less than 2%, if it's even that much, are African-American now. The 20 million acres of land almost that was lost by African-American farmers in this country over the last 90 years. And all the health issues we know that exist. So two of the main speakers there were Monica White, who I'd love to get on this program soon, who's a professor of environmental justice at Wisconsin-Madison, and Ben Burkett, who I also would want to get on the show soon, who's president of the National Family Farm Coalition. What did you take out of that, Imani? I mean, when you listen to Ben Burkett, what did he have to say to you all?
In Dr. White's presentation, I mean, she spoke on something that I was familiar with but not too familiar with.
What was that?
And that the whole civil rights, in Black history, whenever we've organized, whenever we've done something at the foundation of that has been Black farmers and these Black cooperatives, and that now in all Black social justice movements, their presence is no longer there. And she talked about how when there's ever any type of economic turmoil, that people are so quick to go back to the land and let's preserve the earth, let's do all this. But whenever things are okay, we easily forget where we come from and whenever we turn to the land in past instances. So from that, I took away that we need to get back to the issues around cooperatives. We need to get back to organizing around farming, and at the foundation of our health is being able to grow our own foods and to work and have together and have this social capital. What she was speaking of, which is what happens in a cooperative. And right now, I feel like the Black community isn't as organized as it can be. Because there is no social capital. We don't know each other as neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot work together as a collective. So that's one of the biggest takeaways I have from our conversation.
That's interesting. I'm going to explore that a bit more in the time we have left. And Xavier, what about you? I mean, when you heard both Ben Burkett and Dr. Monica White speak, what did you walk away with?
Well, Ben Burke, definitely just the idea and the theme of cooperatives. That was the biggest thing that I took from him. He's in charge of a large cooperative down in the South. And just being around those all those different organizations from all over the country just was really inspiring to know that so many people are on the same page, and I was learning so much about cooperatives and making connections and getting so much information, you know, to bring back to the people I work with, the communities I work with in D.C., to start laying down the foundations for cooperatives and kind of just reintroducing people back to the land and growing their own food, which is kind of a piece of our history that we've forgotten about. And so that's really what I took from both of their presentations.
So, I mean, yeah, I know, because Ben Burke is a fascinating guy, and the organization he runs, the Mississippi Association of Cooperatives, and he's also his organization of the Black Farmers Group is 35 co-ops that represent over 12,000 black farmers from Texas to North Carolina, which is really an amazing group that we don't hear very much about. So I'm curious, what does it say for your own work? When you walk away from this, what does this conference do for you, Imani and Xavier, in terms of the work you're trying to do in the communities you're in, both in Baltimore and Washington? Imani?
Yeah, well, for me, it shows that we have to activate the youth, because with this absence of cooperatives, the lessons that our parents and our parents' parents were bringing down or passing down from generation to generation is being lost within our generation. So that just shows me it's even more important to have school-based community gardens, that we have to teach this upcoming generation about food sovereignty so that that message isn't lost.
And how about for you, Xavier, and what you're doing in D.C.? I mean, how do you see this? I mean, how does it move your work forward?
Man, really, it moves my work forward to go directly towards cooperatives and try to start cooperatives in the particular neighborhood that I'm working in. And it also makes me want to link kind of the urban work I'm doing with the rural farmers and kind of bridge that gap. So that was something that I really kind of got the vision of to really start laying that foundation for. So really just starting cooperatives, because it's possible. Just listen to Mr. Burkett speak, and then Ms. White was talking about just bridging that gap from the urban, you know, the urban black people to the rural black people, and really connecting those those two things. Because there's farmers that grow food, and there's people that need food, and so we have to figure out a way to connect those two. So
in the few minutes we have left, I'm very curious for the both of you. I have like 3 minutes left in the segment. I mean, do you think, can you see and feel a movement, especially in young folks of color, kind of moving back to land, going to farming or gardening at the very least, that's different than the older generations? Do you see a shift around you, Imani, Xavier?
Well, I definitely see a shift. Even in the work that Aaliyah has done, I feel like she herself has activated a lot of youth in Baltimore just via her Instagram messaging and her Facebook messaging to get involved. I didn't really think about it beyond the work that I had done in my school until I met Aaliyah, and I saw, like, she's creating her own individual movement. And I think it's not germane to her in Baltimore, but it's happening across the country.
And how about you, Xavier?
Yeah, for sure, man. I'm just a representative of several African-American-run nonprofits and organizations that are doing a ton of work in D.C., a lot of low-income communities, and really just changing the face of environmentalism and agriculture in the city. So it's definitely a movement that's slowly bubbling.
Well, it's fascinating. I wish I had been at that conference. I want to learn a lot more about it. We might be doing some other segments with some of the speakers of that conference and some of you all coming back to kind of talk with us and see where this movement is going in America. I want to thank Imani Bryant, who's getting her master's degree here at Morgan State University, where we're broadcasting from today, in public health, works on issues of food justice, and Xavier Brown, who runs a nonprofit in D.C. called The Green Scheme. Imani Bryant and Xavier Brown, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care, y'all.
Bye.
And I want to thank all of you for listening here to Soundbites today, reminding you that the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. Our intern is Tashira Smith. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, find information about our guests and what we've talked about today to make those connections, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org, steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.